I kept trying to make it the second Sunday all week, but I'm really glad it's not because I'm not prepared for all of that yet. But I am ready to talk to you this morning about something that's really tender to my heart, and that is this beautiful question. The title of the message is Teachable? Question mark. So are you teachable? I'm inviting you this morning to listen to what it is that I have prepared to say and to look for ways in which you can see that there's room for you to grow. Or there are other ways of taking in lessons as we live our life, as we live through our experiences day to day, and to grow from those teachings. Now, the reason we're talking about this topic of being teachable today is because the CSL, Centers for Spiritual Living, the organization around the world, many of the communities are following the same themes for the year, and we're looking at spiritual values, as Reverend Clyde shared with you. But the value we're looking at for March is about education. And in fact, it says that it is about spiritual living through education and continuous improvement. So, that's right. We're talking about lifelong learning. You know, we're not in this just to learn a little something and move on. We're not in this to learn enough to live a perfect life and get us all of our goals achieved. And that's really what I want to focus on this morning. Let me tell you how Centers for Spiritual Living has outlined the affirmation for the month. It's very lovely. We walk a path of awakening. Can I just tell you I love that word? We walk a path of awakening, growth, and spiritual deepening through classes, workshops, seminars, spiritual practices, and women's retreats. I would just throw in there. Yay, right? How many of you were at the retreat yesterday? Raise your hand. Oh, stand up. I want to see all of you. Stand up. Stand up if you were there. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. So we honor all of this. We believe in it. We work toward it. Classes, workshops, seminars, spiritual practices, women's retreats, and we embrace education as a lifelong endeavor. Yes, now may I hear an amen?
Yes.
All right. Now, whether you signed up for that or not, that is what we do. A long time ago, our founder, Dr. Ernest Holmes, said that we are a teaching and a practicing order, and that it is our job through education to teach people what principle is and how to use it. I knew that would light up Reverend Cheryl. It's kind of how I build, because I know she would like that. So there's something really gorgeous that we are always doing, and my favorite part of that is I have company from Minnesota. My best friend from Arkansas in the 1970s, when we were very young women. My best friend Dory is visiting from St. Paul, and Dory and I have one of those friendships where we don't talk on the phone. We don't see each other very often. It's been 3 years. How much have we talked on the phone in the last 3 years? Maybe twice, right? But we have that ability to reconnect, to just find where we're at, you know? And what we've been doing for several days now is sharing our life experiences that have happened in the last 3 years, and that's creating a beautiful bond for us. And so what I want to talk about today is the way those life experiences truly are those life lessons. So Dr. Ernest Holmes said this in the Science of Mind textbook, page 460 if you're interested. The greatest lesson we have to learn is the unity of love and law. The greatest lesson we have to learn is the unity of love and law. And then he goes on to say that there's a necessity of the law in shaping a divine individuality. So whenever you hear us speak about, we are all individualized expressions of God, that's what we're talking about. That there is a necessity of law that we are always co-creating in this mixture, in the way that the laws of spirituality work just the same way the physical laws of the universe work. And by necessity of that, our divine individuality then has this way of expressing, but he goes on to say that it is also the necessity of experience in awakening us to our divine individuality. Right? I mean, this is really core stuff, but it's exciting. And so if you look at it in another way, you will find very frequently that Holmes would say things like, there are only two realities, two infinite or fundamental truths, these two great realities. One is that there is a divine presence. Amen. That is the place to start. There is a divine presence, and it really don't matter what you call it. And the second part of that is that there is, and you know this one, there is a power for good in this universe, and we can use it. Amen. So good start. Would be a good day to be visiting for the first time. Those are sort of the premises in which we grow on. But here's the lesson that I took from all of that, because we talk about some of this all the time. In fact, intentionally on Sundays, there are certain things I repeat every week. So here's what I learned as I really analyzed that whole message from Holmes about the necessity of the laws shaping us and all of that. What he's saying here is that the unity of love and law is the union of the spiritual with the physical. Okay, so it is that whole thing that we're spiritual beings, but we're human beings. And the whole idea of unity, if you think about it in that way, is how do we meld those together? So it's not like, well, I know I'm a spiritual being and I'm going to be here in my physical life and try really hard to be a good person and to be God will find favor with me. It's not like that. It's more like there's some kind of glorious way it mixes together and we begin to understand the oneness, the interconnectedness of all of life. So it relieves us of any of that duty stuff. It has the potential to relieve you of feeling guilty when you haven't shown up in life in quite the way that you want to. It leads us to have a deeper understanding of what forgiveness and acceptance truly are. And so what we know is that the human experience is the human experience is a part of the whole of our experience, the divine experience as well. So sometimes we only focus on the way our human experience deepens us in our understanding of the divine, but what if it's all equal? What if, this is totally a Karenism right now, a reverend Karenism, a little more authority. What if that means then that our human experience is no less a part of the whole than our spiritual experience? So, I really am feeling like we're onto something because it's such a favorable reception in all these words so far. So what I know about our teaching is that we provide education and we encourage growth. We know that, you know, it's lifelong learning. It's a lifelong endeavor. And so what I'm talking about today is this way we are or can be actively involved in our own growth, participating in our own life rather than feeling victimized by what's going on in life. And are we consciously making decisions that promote our own growth? That is being teachable. Now, when we look at the this gorgeous thing we teach here, the four stages of spiritual growth, I'll be doing that on Wednesday night in the foundation class. We've been looking forward to it. I've been chatting it up for a while. And so this week we're going to really dive deep in understanding how those four stages of spiritual growth apply to our personal life, our growing. And so what we say is that everybody starts as a victim. We all start where we are, we feel a little helpless. Maybe, you know, even if you look at childhood, being a baby, you grow up, you get more powerful, you get smarter, you get wiser because you hopefully pay a little attention while you're living. But that eventually, no matter how old you are, there seems to be a point where most of us, not all of us, and you will be able to agree with this as you look around and see what's going on in your own circle of people in your life or the people you see when you're out in public or whatever, but most of us get to a point where we become very tired of feeling victimized by stuff or people in the world, and it's like we put up a hand and go, enough. It's like we give a sign to the universe or God or spirit, whatever you want to call it, and say, yeah, that's enough of that. There has to be another way. And we open ourselves to whatever that guidance is that will show us how to do it differently. So if you are in stage one, you then rise up to the second kingdom or the second stage of consciousness or spiritual development, in which we figure out we're pretty powerful. That we all we have to do is make choice in our life and not just be like bounced around by stuff. We start making choices, we begin to feel empowered rather than victimized, and then we consequently will begin to manifest change in our life, and that may show up in the way of better conditions. And so it doesn't matter what religion you are or what spiritual tradition you come from, these steps fit all of us, including those who do not consider themselves spiritual at all or on a spiritual path. So you grow from feeling helpless to feeling empowered, but that's not the end. What happens next as we continue our growth is that something strikes us and we slip into this deeper place where we have a different kind of experience in our connection to life. We begin to, it's almost like courting the divine or having an experience of communion with spirit. And we now are touching the mystical experience. Every faith has a description of what that's like. Every spiritual tradition has witnesses that have tried to write about it and express it. So in the third kingdom, it's as though we something shifts and we suddenly are clear about what it means to say, oh, not my will, but thy will be done. That there is a way that life, that God, that infinite intelligence of all the universe will begin to work through us. And as we actively recognize that, we now have not only learned to manifest and to demonstrate the better conditions in our life, but we drop down into the mystical where we are now blending love and law, and we are experiencing the union with God. And then the fourth kingdom goes up again. We describe it in boxes. And the final kingdom is truly that oneness with God where there is no more experience of feeling separate from God. Now, the beauty of this is, just like I said at the top of the talk, is that it's not a goal. We're not working towards that. It's lovely when that happens, and we never stay in any one place. We are constantly moving through all four stages, and it looks like that infinity symbol, if you think about it that way. So when the world wallops us with something hard to imagine, we can get grounded by turning within. So we might feel victimized for a while, right? It feels out of control because we as a single being, what can we do about the tsunami or the anything, you name it, I'm not gonna. And we are consequently now actively participating in that lifelong learning. Here's what I notice. Many of the lessons that life brings us through experiences are not lessons we particularly asked for. They're not ones we put a lot of intention in or purposely chose. They just sort of show up and then we get to do the work around it. Khalil Gibran said, I have learned silence from the talkative, toleration from the intolerant, and kindness from the unkind. Yet it's strange, I am ungrateful to these teachers. Right? Right? We'll relate to that. We get that. We get that. So many of the great thinkers have penned similar words. Walt Whitman said, "You have learned lessons from those who admired you and were tender with you. But have you not also learned great lessons from those who braced themselves against you and disputed the passage with you?" So, I mean, Yes, you're all thinking of it. Somebody came to mind, didn't it? Somebody that disputed. Yes. So sometimes we study things that we want to learn, and sometimes we learn things because they have just come into our life. And I just, for one, want to be teachable. I don't want to miss an opportunity to learn a lesson. Some of those lessons you don't want to have to do a second time, right? It's better to, it's kind of like the person that gets divorced and then marries the same person, except it's not really the same person because you haven't figured out what that was, and that you don't have to keep torturing yourself that way. Some people have many experiences in getting wise. So can we be open to the lessons that are there in front of us? Can we develop some sort of an attitude that gives us an expectation, maybe even a joyous expectation, that we're going to learn from whatever comes our way? But I would just say that I just notice that not everybody is open to the lessons. And I notice, if I'm going to speak personally, that there are times in my life where I'm open and willing, and then there are other times in my life where I just am, hell no, not now, I am not dealing with that now. When we are resistant, that's where we bring the odds up that we're going to get smacked later with that cosmic 2x4. So just know that we're participating whether we choose it or not. There's always a consequence. Ernest Holmes says that we are not, our ignorance does not excuse us from the outcome. We still have to live in the life we're creating. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about the Peace Pilgrim. You know who the Peace Pilgrim is? Oh my word, yeah, what an amazing human being she is. So the Peace Pilgrim is really a woman named Mildred Norman. She married somebody and was Mildred Norman Ryder for a short period of time. That didn't work out. And she had a sort of she called it a direct mystical experience with God's love. She actually called it the Creator's love. And after, she was meditating, and something crazy happened, and she realized that she had this really big, powerful call to be a pilgrim for peace. And she adapted the name, the Peace Pilgrim, at that time. Now, to give you an idea of the time frame this all unfolded, she was born in 1908. That means she was about 20 years younger than Ernest Holmes. You know my life. Everything goes around Ernest Holmes. He's my timeline for everything. And so that also says to me that she kind of came of age, was a young adult. When Holmes was speaking, when Holmes began lecturing, and she was on the West Coast for a period of time, and at least a period of time, and her message was what she believed was that humanity, all of us, could learn to accept what life brings us, that we could grow through our life experiences, and those could be our learning experiences, but that all of life held some potential for that, for us. And she lived from 1908 to 1981. She was 72 when she made her transition. But here's what's really cool. When she was 44 years old and she had this experience of being called by the Creator's love, she gave up her life in the way that she knew it. She gave away all her belongings. She had no material belongings, and she began to walk across the United States. She traveled across the United States and Canada. She actually ended up doing it 7 times in her lifetime. That was all she did for the next 28 years. She started in 1953. This is interesting. She started her first trek on January 1st of 1953 in Pasadena, California. And in 1953, I lived in Pasadena, California. I was 2 years old. I don't remember her. And I was thinking that, you know, what was happening that day would be the Rose Parade. She probably didn't go to the Rose Parade. But that was the day she began walking back and forth across the United States and Canada. And in 1964, so she had done that for 11 years, she had counted up 25,000 miles she had walked, and she decided to quit counting. And imagine, she just kept walking for a number of years until she made her transition in 1981. Now, this woman was considered to be a spiritual teacher, a mystic. She really took a strong stand for peace on earth, and she took a personal vow to be a wanderer. She said, until humankind figures out how to have peace on earth, I'm just going to keep walking. Which she would still be walking, wouldn't she? We're still working on that. And what's really awesome about her is that she would walk. Sort of reminds me of some of what I read about Siddhartha's story of how Buddha came to be. She would walk until somebody gave her shelter. She would fast until somebody offered her food. And she never asked for food or shelter. This was just the way she lived. She carried no money with her. And the real intriguing part is one of those rather ironic conclusions, in that she was killed in a car accident in 1981, 72 years old. She would occasionally be invited to speak. So she was being driven to a speaking engagement from Chicago to Indiana, and was involved in an accident that killed her. And there she left this great legacy, and it is a book. You can read it, or you can research her on the internet. She's really, it's a great story. She had to be really quirky. You know, it had to be really interesting to meet her. Anybody here ever hear her or meet her? You've heard about, yes. How many of you have heard about her? That's a good, let's see a show of hands. So good amount of you have. The Peace Pilgrim believed that humanity could mature in the same way that children grow up and become more mature. And she believed that our problem is that we always come back to the same issue, and that is our resistance to work on improving ourselves. So she clearly was a human being who stood for lifelong learning. I mean, she really says that in so much of what she writes. But she also created these four things we can do for our own improvement. Now, this so speaks of the same teaching that we offer here in this philosophy, the science of mind, that I really do have to wonder. Some of the terms she uses are very much like our terms. And I would guess that she may have been privy to hearing Dr. Holmes speak from occasion to occasion. And by the way, also, was that too many by the ways? Also, Chris Lockman is going to put on the Facebook page, as well as in our weekly blog that we send out, our little weekly newsletter, she will have these four things printed because I sent them to you already. So, number one, Peace Pilgrim said that the first step to something we can do to improve ourselves or to continue our own growth is to have a right attitude. She said that when we face life squarely, we can get down below the froth. Isn't that a gorgeous statement? If you face life squarely, we can get down to the truth that is below all the froth. And I think there's something gorgeous in that. In fact, it reminds me of the way Holmes always says, we have to look at the discordant fact. We have to see what it is so we will know what the truth is. You have to see the discordance first. So we can, if we do that, she says, we will solve all the problems that life sets before us. We will be able to solve that, and that really is the only way we grow. Okay, so you got to get down below the froth. Number two, live good beliefs. I like that statement. Can we live good beliefs? And she speaks about, in this particular segment, about the way we can learn to be obedient to the laws that push us toward harmony. See, this is the very law that we talk about here all the time. I am always speaking about that pattern of perfection, that when I get still, when I get quiet, when I open myself to that divine imagination, just as you do when you sit still, that we then see that there's a pattern, or we can feel that there's a way we can show up in our life that's a little bit different than the way we were. So it starts with that attitude, and then we live according to our good beliefs, because we're going to be leaning toward harmony as we do that, because it's the law. And then the third thing is that we can find our place in the pattern. We can find our place in what I call the divine pattern. That is that idea of perfection. It is like that intelligence in our bodies that knows you get a cut, your body immediately starts healing that. So we have to do our part. These are her words. We do our part in the scheme of things. We find out what our part is because we're all individual. And we are part of the whole. That's the way I would look at it in terms of the way I say it here. And the thing is, you can only figure out what's yours. I waste a lot of time trying to tell Hugh what his part is. 46 years I've been with that man, and I still think I can change him, I guess, on some level. But I love you, honey. Though he did... He did get here on time today. So if I look at that, we are part of the whole. I'm going to go right back to that Holmes quote at the top of the morning. Law shapes, experience wakes. The law shapes us as to our individual divinity, our individual expression, based on our thoughts and our ideas, our beliefs. So the law shapes us and experience wakes us, and then we can go deeper. And finally, number four, she says that we really need to simplify. Now, this is a woman who gave away everything she owns, so I don't completely trust her. I like my stuff. You know I like my stuff. But she's not just talking about our stuff. She's talking about the way we can simplify everything, our beliefs, our thoughts. I mean, just think how sweet it is after you meditate and your mind is a little slower and life looks a little less cluttered. So there are ways we can apply all of this. So she does sound like a Science of Mind student to me in many ways. What I can tell you is she's certainly a devout student of life, and she is a great example of someone who lived a life being teachable. Took a stand for it even. Now, as I thought about this, I was thinking about the things that block us from some of these easy truths. What gets in our way? You know, what is it that stops this from being as easy as it sounds like it could be? And I think that just in our living, in a physical world, in physical bodies, that there's this high risk of being, you know, surprised by our experiences, because things are uncertain in physical form, because they're always changing. It's the eternal truths, it's the spiritual truths, it's law or principle that is unchanging, that never changes, but in life, we experience change, and so we get uncomfortable when things are uncertain. People have written whole books about it. My favorite is Pema Chodron. Pema has that book, Comfortable with Uncertainty. There's great languaging on this idea of being comfortable with the with ambiguity, and just the way that things we can't control, like our husbands and. So there's uncertainty in the world, and our job is then not to try and make it all certain, but what I notice is when things get a little strange, we start trying to reorder everything and put it back together really quick so we can feel better about it. And we meet somebody that we can't quite figure out, and we want to put them in a box. We want to figure it out and see, and we're going to squish them in a box. And over here, then an incident happens in the world, and it makes no sense at all, and we're going to try and jam it in a circle because it looks like a circle, and that's how it's going to make sense to me. But the reality is we do not live in a one-size-fits-all world. I mean, do we not know that? You shop one-size-fits-all? Come on. Come on. So we start to attempt to have some to get rid of the chaos, the seeming chaos. We try to order things, and we begin to separate them and place them where we think they need to be. But what we're really doing is creating now judgments that if he doesn't fit in that box, that's not going to work for me. Right? Or if that belief, the direction that my boss is taking the company in now, that's not going to work for me because I had it all figured out. I knew how to do that SAP thing that you do that I don't know anything about. So our risk is in the way we too quickly try and find order when the chaos or the disorder is often leading us to a new way of fitting together. You've heard me say it before. So our attempts to categorize and reorder things is really where all the judgment begins. It is also, if you think about it, how things get polarized. Here I am. Oh, I get it. This is what I believe right now. But look at all of them. They don't agree. How am I going to make all them believe like I do? Because I think I'm on to something pretty good here. Polarization happens. We get into that place where there are different sides. And so we can see that the best illustrations of polarization is, say, religion. If you look at a religion where there is a whole culture around it, then when somebody doesn't fit in with that, we're polarized. We're looking at other sides. We see it in politics. We even see it in, I was thinking like our eating trends, you know. I love to eat nutritiously. I don't do it all the time, but I love to do it. And then I want other people in my life to eat like I'm eating, right? But it's not going to be how other people want to eat. And we do that. And some of us are even, you know, really enthusiastic about it. And we believe it's, as a matter of fact, I read that the Peace Pilgrim was a vegetarian activist. Right? So we get on our we could say high horse, I guess, or well-walked sandals, and we think that that's the way things need to be, but we then create division. We create separation. Now, everything about being human stirs this urge for us to find our tribe, to connect, to know who your peeps are, so you can hang out and you can have agreement and all of that. But that is sort of a primal way of, we have looked at it as primal, we have looked at it as a bit of a tribal mentality, and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, we all want to feel like we belong somewhere. But I would say, I think it's more than that. I think that way we have a need to belong has to do with that intuitive nature, that the way the soul knows there is a way for us to all connect with each other into an experience of oneness. So it's not just oneness with God, though that is the ultimate, but it is an acceptance, an acknowledgement of the union of love and law and in the diversity of humanity. So when we end up sort of inadvertently putting ourselves in a group, let's say all our vegetarian friends start. We did that here once. We had a raw cooking or something. It was really fun. I just wanted to eat. I didn't want to work. But when we do that, we want to notice that we're not, you know, you're trying to bring people in who don't want to be there, then we don't want to be excluding others, and it gets kind of tricky. Now, the other thing that happens is you bring people together, then you got to start setting some guidelines as to how we're going to do it. You know, I don't care if it's the woman's group or the woman's retreat or, you know, the sound booth team. It don't matter. We have to have some guidelines as to how we're going to do all that, and we need somebody to stand in authority as the leader of that. Otherwise, there is total chaos. It's difficult to co-lead things, right? It can be. I find it fun and sometimes interesting. But I love that way you look for your fit when you're co-leading. But not everybody can do that. And so as we're doing that, and the guidelines start turning into rules, and it looks like the group's not going in the direction you were hoping the group would go on, what happens? We start criticizing. We might start pointing fingers, maybe even blaming, and voila, a new polarization has been created, a new divide, yet another way of separation. And that is because blaming and criticizing and finger pointing is always externalizing. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. You're looking outside of yourself and you're wanting something out here to be different than it is, you are externalizing yourself, and you are, we so sweetly always try and rearrange people or things and to make it more pleasing. But the real key to happiness, the real key to living a satisfactory life does not come from changing anything out here. It is about the way we can internalize and make the choices within and the changes within our own self. That is your attitude, right? We're talking about your attitude. We're talking about our beliefs. We're talking about the choice of how we show up in those circumstances. So that stuff happens. And the benefit is to pay attention. Am I externalizing, or is there something here I can gain from taking it within? The Peace Pilgrim said, so powerful. If you realized how powerful your thoughts are, you would never think another negative thought. See, we know it. We can be in agreement with it. So the trick is in not excluding other views. Polarization and, you start looking at the dark and the light. We get into transpersonal psychology and we see there's a shadow dance. And what we see is that the shadow dance happens when beliefs are polarized and we think we're standing in the light and we're projecting then outside of us. Great, interesting quote I found from a gentleman named Bernard Gunther, who is a bit of a kind of a thought leader, I would say, a contemporary right now, who writes a lot and teaches a lot, coaches a lot about the transitions that the world is going through. This is the way he said it. When you act like slaves, you get masters. So what I'm trying to say here yet again today is that contrast is good because it helps us see what we really want. Contrast serves us. It can redirect us. It is when our experiences wake us up, and let's face it, sometimes we are blasted awake because something has come down in our life and we're triggered, we're angry, we're sad, we're scared. We don't know what to do. We got to make a decision. We get fussy. But they're just experiences that are awakening within us, because I believe there is a divine desire that is bigger and greater than anything we can imagine in our own mind that is trying to come forth on this planet, and it can only come forth through us. So sure, we're stirred. We're looking now. We're all alert because we have been sort of jolted awake. And what I want to say is, this is a time to really look at yourself and ask, am I teachable? None of us knows it all. Am I teachable? See, when we are teachable, we can see that unexpected things come and go. That life is like that, that yes, those things that come and touch our lives sort of reshape us. And when I wrote those words, and I was thinking about it, I was thinking about how hard we try not to, we try so hard to be good, or we try so hard to reach this goal of spiritual achievement or enlightenment or whatever it is. But circumstances come, and we have a response to it, and we often have a sudden reaction to it. Maybe that's not pretty, but what if that's okay? What if that is the way we get the lesson? So I thought this. As I was writing this down, I thought, things happen. Let's take it out of the realm of anything that's going on in the world. Let's look at nature. Sometimes natural disasters just happen. Acts of God, they used to call them, right? I don't think it's an act of God. I think that stuff just happens. So let's say, for instance, there's a mountain, and one day, unexpectedly, a huge volcano, it erupts, and it blows off the top of the mountain, and forevermore, the shape of that mountain is different. It will never look like what it used to look like. But not only that explosive volcano will change the entire landscape for miles around it. Now, we can blame God. You know, I think it created some funny images in my mind, like, oh, must be God up there playing with explosives again, you know, trying to show us how powerful he is, you know. Or we could think about it as God is just rearranging the planet in the same way you might rearrange the furniture in your living room. But we know that we don't believe that here. We don't teach of a God that is trying to change us or mess with us or punish us or even gift us with this goodness if we earn it. We believe in the givingness of grace from God into every life all the time, and that it is about the way that we reorder our understanding that we can then open to receive it, to benefit it from it. So the volcano erupts because the planet is alive and she is always changing. Stuff happens. We understand that there are certain combinations of circumstances that are volatile, right? A death in a family can create everybody else in the family to explode and change the face of the mountain and the landscape so it never looks the same again. Certain combinations of conditions or circumstances are volatile. We all know that because we have, whether we have participated or believe we have or not participated, we have watched it. But life, my friends, is always reshaping itself. Every time I go to the Central Coast, the bluffs look a little different. So it would serve us to realize that the goal of life isn't about being perfect. I think that religion has done a fine job of giving us this idea that if we live good enough, there will be a reward in the afterlife, after we're done with all this. So you better try to do good. You know, it's either that, it's either a great reward or a terrible consequence. And so we see, if you look at all the different beliefs in different religions, that there's the reward of heaven, or there's the reward of eternal life on a paradise earth. There's a reward in certain faiths that you'll get your own planet if you do everything well. And there certainly is that whole story about all the virgins that I don't really understand that one at all. But maybe life is just life, and you can't get it wrong, and you never get it done. Would that be okay? All right, the law shapes us, experience wakes us. Let us just learn from our experiences. All right, so get yourself nice and comfortable, and while we're moving to that sacred place of prayer, I would like for you to rethink everything that just happened and open yourself to that tiny gem that is yours. We just feel the peace that rests in this room and in this quiet moment. We turn to that sacred place inside and recognize that right here is God. Right here in this very room is the infinite wisdom of all the universe, is the healing power of spirit itself. I feel and sense that power, and I know it is a power for good, and we can use it. And I feel the love of God within me. Love, the most powerful force in the universe. I feel it in sensitive, that activity of life, that which is ever present, that which is the highest wisdom of the ages, that is everything that has ever unfolded in the history of life and everything that will unfold in the future. I feel the love of God, and I recognize that it is that divine light that has called us together this day. And so as we stand in these eternal truths, as we recognize the union of love and law, knowing we are one with it, as we rest and rejoice in this beautiful truth that there are universal spiritual principles that we can tap into and use to find our place, the way that our good choices push us towards the great harmony of all of life. I see that we come together in a new way, ready for all of our experiences. And so wherever there is a call for healing, a restoration of health, I simply know that we are activating the cells in the body. We are activating the law of circulation so that every organ, every cell, every tissue, every molecule in the body knows how to do exactly what it is here to do. And that all those who we care about, or for ourselves, that we are restored to the truth of our being, that there is a perfect pattern that circulates in our physical bodies. And we are aligned to that perfection right now, and truth is revealing itself as we are restored to wholeness, as we are vibrant and vital in this very body. And I know that as we move through all of our relationships, that there too is the presence of God. It is the presence of love. It is that same essence of life that has a restorative power, so that we are moved to understand what our role is in this gift of forgiveness. That we know that God is always giving and enhancing our relationships as we open ourselves to receive, because if God is forgiving, we must be for receiving. So I am grateful to know that wherever there appears to be any sense of limitation, the fullness of Spirit itself, the infinite intelligence of all the universe, is activated right now to break through any appearance of limitation or restriction or not enough, because we know who our source is. It is not an external power. It is the power of God. It is the power of Spirit. It is an indwelling presence, and we are one with that power now. And I say thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, Infinite Spirit, for this awakening.